Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is October 26th. This is 2011 and show number 5 with our co-host, Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD, who is a fourth-generation homeopath. And so many years of experience and growing up with homeopathy around him has really provided a great deal of knowledge to the database of homeopathy. We're having a problem right now, as typically we do, in calling in to the line. He is going to supposedly be talking about cardiology and heart failure. For some reason, he's saying that he's unable to connect to the show, and we're going to see if we can sort that out. So hopefully he will be able to, I don't know whether he can hear me live. He is in the chat room and can post messages there for us. But we're supposed to be talking about cardiology and heart failure today, what is a cardiac failure and the possible causes, and the mechanisms of the body for combating this type of a condition, and actually what leads to a cardiac arrest, I imagine, in the end. So we're still waiting for him to call in, and hopefully he will be able to do that shortly. Okay.
Hello.
We see you on the line now. Fantastic. Maybe I gave you the wrong number to call in today, but you are on live with us. I was doing a little scrounging around and found out some things about cardiology and heart failure and things that are happening in the news, but I'm sure people want to learn from you specifically about homeopathic remedies that you use in the clinic. So
exactly.
Why don't you start us off with what is cardiac failure, so people have a baseline of understanding.
Before I do so, I wish all the viewers, especially Indians, a very happy and healthy Diwali and a prosperous New Year ahead. And as entire India and Indians residing abroad are engulfed in Diwali celebrations, we kickstart this show.
Fantastic. Is it a whole week of celebration, Dr. Adil?
Yeah, it's 10 days of celebrations. Actually, in spite of sitting in a completely closed room, still crackers are all around me. It's a celebration. And throughout India, people will celebrate this for full 10 days.
Is this the holiday with all the colors?
Yeah. It's complete holiday, including, every institution is closed today. Today is 26th, the first day of Diwali, and it's a very auspicious day for all Indians, especially Hindus. But when we celebrate, all communities get together and celebrate. It's a wonderful time.
I understand it's the Festival of Lights.
Exactly. And hopefully, with this continuation of light, both spiritual light and light around us, we continue with our show. In fact, last Thursday, I had got three callers. One, Dr. Mariam from Karachi, Pakistan, whose four-year-old son has got pulmonary hypertension, and she was asking how homeopathy could help. Likewise, Mr. Smith Adams from San Diego, whose 36-year-old wife has got a portal hypertension, and Mr. Alistair Biden from Kangaroo, Queensland, Australia, just wrote to me that the interview was amazing and he would like to know something about rhythm disorders in the next episode. So these are a few feedbacks which I got personally.
Wonderful. So that means that people are listening to the show and learning about what homeopathy can do for them. And
exactly.
And that's why we really, really appreciate having you on the show.
Yeah, I'm honored to do the show. Talking about today about cardiac failure. See, basically, heart is a very resilient organ and one of the most resilient organs of all the other organs compared to like the liver or the kidneys and the brain. And when there's an inability of the heart muscle to pump blood at the rate at which does not meet the requirement of the cells of the body or the metabolizing tissue, we call this as cardiac failure or congestive cardiac failure. Basically, it is not a disease, rather it's an end result of the disease. And the disease basically may be from the heart, either cardiac origin or a non-cardiac origin. Now, before going into heart failure, the heart tries itself level best for various degrees of compensation. There's an interesting mechanism called as Frank-Starling mechanism, which is there only in the cardiac muscle, wherein the heart muscle keeps on stretching if it is exposed to great varying degrees of stress. So it keeps on stretching like a rubber band, and thereby it increases the force of contraction. This leads to something called as hypertrophy of the heart. And eventually, to conserve itself, then it will retain salt, retain water, so that the BP increases, the blood pressure increases. Then the sympathetic circulation, the sympathetic nervous system will get affected and cause vasoconstriction. That means all the arteries will decrease in the diameter so that again the BP rises. The heart rate also rises to compensate. Then there is a selective supply to essential organs. For example, in the normal times, the heart has got, supplies blood to every single part. But in times of crisis, like when the heart is failing, it reduces the blood to non-essential areas like the intestines and conserves blood only for essential organs like the brain, the liver, the kidneys, etc. And lastly, the body initiates a cough reflex to expel out pooled plasma and blood in the interalveolar space in the lungs. So these are some of the physiological adaptations or compensatory mechanisms which the heart undergoes. And undergoes of a long time, a period it will take about, say, 3, 4, 5 months or more, rather a year. But eventually, if these fail, then what we call as cardiac failure or congestive cardiac failure ends up.
Okay, so this is a little introduction to the capacity and how the heart and the circulatory system deals with stress that from many different reasons, and that each show it seems that the word stretching or this capacity of the muscle to expand and contract is a very big deal with this system of the body, and that the ability of the body to protect itself in certain mechanistic ways to just supply the blood where it needs to in the vital organs. Is this the vital force at work?
Yeah, see, vital force preserve is a basic property of vital force is to preserve itself. And for self-preservation, it will do anything. Rather, the basic ethos, the concept of living is self-preservation. And heart itself has got its own mechanism. The entire cardiovascular system has got a mechanism to preserve itself. And to the very last, till the very end of its capacity, it will preserve itself. And ultimately, if the pressure, the external pressure or the external disease still continues, only then it will fail. But then failure is again reversible and irreversible. In the very initial phases, the congestive cardiac failure is still in reversible phase. But still, if the disease goes on and progressing, then ultimately the heart fails.
Okay, so people probably feel like they have this something we might call a window of opportunity, a time span when something homeopathic or lifestyle changes can really make a difference in their life.
Exactly. I mean, a long window. People should realize and should not get disheartened, those who have got heart failure. They have a good window of opportunity to coming back to so-called normal, at least if not normal, near normal to life, even irrespective of heart failure, and need not continue drugs which are diuretics, which are given for lifelong. Digitalis is the drug of choice, even in modern medicine, which has to be taken lifelong for such patients. I mean, that need not be the case every time in all patients.
Well, I'm sure people would love to know that they don't necessarily have to take a drug for their entire life, which may alter other parts of their body, affect them in other ways with side effects and also the cost involved.
Exactly. Now, there are so many different causes why this congestive cardiac failure takes place. I mean, it can be because of the heart disease itself or some other disorders in which the heart has been innocently involved. For example, congenital heart disease. Many congenital heart diseases like a ventricular septal defect or a patent ductus arteriosus or TOF, what you call tetralogy of Fallot, they can end up, or over a period of time, they do end up in congestive cardiac failure. Or acquired heart diseases like valvular incompetencies, aortic stenosis, aortic regurgitation, or infection of the heart like endocarditis. Various different types of arrhythmias, they can lead to heart failure per se. But then, there are certain precipitating causes. For example, I don't have a disease of heart, and if I get a myocardial infarction, a sudden attack, heart attack, that itself can lead to a decrease in my cardiac efficiency and thereby cause heart failure. Or, for some reason, I've been giving inappropriate fluid therapy, intravenous fluid therapy, and the fluid overload takes place, thereby leading to heart failure. If I'm suffering from cancer, certain anti-cancer drugs are known to cause heart failure. If I'm giving blood transfusion wrongly, or if I suffer from some systemic infections like septicemia or typhoid, or dengue, which unfortunately the epidemic of dengue is going around throughout India now. A lot of people end up in heart failure. Or if I've got cirrhosis of liver or kidney disease, uremia, again heart failure. Or simple systemic hypertension, or pulmonary hypertension, which we have discussed last time. Or diabetes, cigarette smoking and obesity. You'll be wonderstruck that cigarette smoking and obesity cause itself can cause heart failure in around 16% of patients. I mean, that's quite a high figure. So that's a positive note to reduce weight in people who are obese and stop cigarettes, those who are smokers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, what was that percentage that you gave for the cigarette smoking and obesity contributing to the potential of heart failure?
16.
16%.
That's quite a lot. I mean, it's a huge figure.
Yeah. And so people, if they realize it, but again, it is very difficult for a person who thinks that their smoking is reducing their tension, their emotional tension, is by stopping to smoking, they're afraid they're going to then become obese and eat too much. So it seems to be a circular pattern that people are having a difficult time getting out of. Perhaps counseling and some homeopathics that you use have shown some promise.
Exactly. I mean, so lifestyle changes, we need to focus on certain addictions like smoking and definite decrease of obesity by, say, diet, what we have discussed, blood group diet. We'll be discussing sometime in some lecture, blood group diet, or by following healthy exercises, and the exercises should be very individualist exercises. Now, obesity, now there are different types of obesity. What we call is morbid obesity and a genetic obesity. I mean, you may be fat right from the beginning, you may be plumpy, you may be flabby, but in the functional level, you are not that disturbed. But then suppose if you develop obesity in suddenly in your life, say within past 1 year or past 2 years, and you cannot get rid of the fat, or you have developed obesity which is restricted in the abdomen or the hips, which we call apple-shaped obesity, that obesity is a dangerous obesity, and that may lead to congestive cardiac failure.
Right. There are a lot of studies showing that this body shape makes a big difference, and they can use it as a predictor to your heart health.
Yeah, we really do. I mean, patients coming to me, we definitely take the waist-hip ratio. The waist-hip ratio in Indian males should be less than 0.9, and Indian females should be less than 0.8. So if it is more, then technically, even if you don't look obese, then technically you are obese. And that obesity needs to be reduced. The exercises need to be focused on that part of obesity and not general reduction of weight. I mean, many people are just happy reducing 1 or 2, 3 or 4 kgs. That's not good. I mean, if you have to reduce pounds, you have to reduce it even on the abdomen as well as hips.
Okay, so I'm looking forward to a session when we say, what are the exercises that you recommend? Like, I don't know whether you do recommend sit-ups, but things like that, whether that is going to help make a difference in toning a particular part of the body.
Exactly. That will be taken in a separate session. But now, okay, since we are focusing about heart failure, I mean, we have different types of heart failure. For example, the right heart can fail exclusively, meaning thereby the right ventricle and the right atrium, or the left side can fail, left atrium or the left ventricle, or both can fail. Then the heart failure can set in suddenly, acute heart failure, or maybe over a period of weeks to months or years. So this is called chronic heart failure, and eventually we give a technical name to it called as cardiomyopathy. Cardiomyopathy. Myo means muscle. Then we can have a low output failure, when in the output, the heart functioning is low and the output is also low in hypothyroid people. I mean, people who have got hypothyroidism and uncontrolled hypothyroidism or aortic stenosis, there the output goes down and the heart fails. Or vice versa, we may have a high output failure in patients who have got systemic hypertension or severe anemia, which is uncontrolled even by giving medications, or hyperthyroid people. These people have got high output failure, wherein the heart tries to function too fast, but the efficacy is very low. But in homeopathy, we would rather classify heart failures into three types. Edema predominant heart failure, I mean, people who have got edema or swelling as the primary symptom of heart failure. And second, breathlessness predominant heart failure, or both. So these are three types, and they actually help us in categorizing patients of heart failure.
Can you please repeat again? You said three different classifications or two?
No, three different classifications. Edema predominant, that means people who have got swelling as a primary feature of heart failure. Breathlessness predominant, wherein breathlessness is the primary feature of heart failure, or may have both. Some people can have both. So we've got all the three different types of heart failures, and that is a great help how a homeopath assesses patients of heart failure.
Okay. And is this something that somebody is going to observe in the patient per se, or the patient will come in and say this is a symptom that they have?
I mean, yes, if the patients are intelligent enough, they can visualize, they can notice swelling over the feet. I mean, they can say that I never had swelling, but now I'm working for 8 hours, and then at the end of the day, I feel my socks are too tight, or my shoes are too tight, or the bangles which I'm wearing, or the watch which I'm wearing, that doesn't seem to fit, or the ring which I'm wearing, that is becoming too tight. Or someone else may comment that you have got swelling under your lids or over your lids. When you have got such type of comments, a patient should be made aware, or a patient should recognize that could be a sign of heart failure. Likewise, effort intolerance or fatigue, easy fatigue and breathlessness. Now, New York Heart Association is a body which has categorized breathlessness into four types, wherein it's very easy for clinical assessment of the patient and thereby assessing the heart failure. Class 1, if a patient has got heart failure, but there are no symptoms from ordinary activities. One can do your ordinary work, if you do an extraordinary work, then you might have got breathlessness. In class 2, there is slight limitation of activity. The patient is comfortable at rest or with mild exertion. Class 3, we have got marked limitation of any activity. Even the routine ones, there's a marked limitation and the patient is comfortable only at rest. And class 4, any sort of physical activity brings on discomfort and symptoms occur at rest. So these are 4 classes and they help a homeopath or any physician for that matter to grade the patient into what sort of, what category the patient, this severity, this heart patient has come to us of heart failure. That's a very good assessment from the patient's size and it only requires is a history. So that is important when we are assessing heart failure patients.
So you can determine the class without actually having to do any clinical evaluation or lab work even at the outset, but I'm sure that you do.
A simple physician, a basic primary physician, even the patient, it's very easy, swelling or breathlessness. If it's persistent, if it's occurring generalized, then one needs to go in, one needs to think about of heart failure and then can go in for various types of tests.
Okay, and then did you want to talk about the homeopathic remedies or the rubrics or something like that on where the homeopath would go next?
Yeah, but before that, I mean, I would like for the homeopathic physicians to know that what would they, suppose if the patient has come with either of these two or both of these two symptoms, then what do you do? One needs to know that in acute heart failure, one of the primary symptoms is called as paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. Paroxysmal means sudden, nocturnal means night, and dyspnea means breathlessness. So we have got paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. It's a classical feature of left ventricular failure. Now what happens actually is, the patient can go into bed, say at 10 o'clock at night. He goes, sleeps, and suddenly in one hour or so later, he wakes up and starts gasping for breath. He wants windows open, wants fan in spite of the air conditioning being on. He wants air circulation, the typical carbovet symptom, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. It's a classical symptom of left ventricular failure. And it is so said that unless otherwise proved, this is heart failure. So that means you have to evaluate such a patient. When you see in such patients the neck veins, even patients are complaining of swelling, if you see the neck veins, normally the neck veins are not so prominent. The neck arteries may be prominent, but neck veins are not prominent. But if you see the jugular veins which have become prominent, then you may be dealing with the patient of heart failure. Or if you take a stethoscope and put it on the chest and you can hear some rails, the bubbling sounds, then yes, apart from pneumonia, if you can hear it in both the lungs, then it can be a failure, a very well documented failure. Then there is something called as heart sounds. So the first heart sound is lup dup, lup dup, lup dup. But suppose if you hear on the stethoscope, like the gallop of the horse, this is another remarkable feature of left ventricular failure. And this cannot be missed. Then we can have, other symptoms like ankle edema. It's a persistent edema over the ankles. Night cough. The daytime, the patient says, the daytime I don't get cough, but the moment I start lying on my back, like typical Drosera or hyoscyamus, I get dry cough, which comes out from the throat. Then you have got the breathlessness because of pleural effusion. The pulse becomes faster. The normal pulse rate in an average adult it would be somewhere between 80 to 90 or 70 to 80 per minute. Then it goes on increasing to 100, 120, more than 120 persistently is a sign of heart failure. And the patient then complains of persistent constriction in the chest, constriction especially in falling asleep, falling at night. So these are very, very prominent symptoms in adults. But then mind you friends, not only adults, small babies, neonates, from birth to 28 days, the period is called neonatal period. These babies, if they have got a congenital heart disease and land up in failure, it's very easy to recognize. The mother should know this. The baby will have feeding difficulty, failure to gain weight and grow, tachypnea. After small feeds, the baby would take deep breaths, sighing respiration, what we called. and excess diaphoresis. After every feed, the baby collapses, like literally collapses, is so tired. This is a very, very important symptom that the mother can see in the patient, and it is a symptom of heart failure unless otherwise proved. And in slightly older child, say from 29, 30 days, or 1 month child to say 3 months, the baby can have excess sweating, unusual sweating. In a given environment, the baby should not sweat more than the average others. But then if there's unusual sweating or repeated pulmonary infection, that you have to go to the doctor time and again for pneumonia, not only simple respiratory tract infections, upper respiratory tract infections, laryngitis or bronchitis, but you need to go to the doctor for pneumonia. Or the baby has got frequent respiratory distress when he or she is drinking the milk in a supine position, and you have to lift him or her up, tap on the back, repeated respiratory distress is there. Flaring of LA nasi. Normally, babies do not have, the LA nasi is the wings of the nose, what you call. They are accessory muscles of respiration. So they don't need to be, I mean, prominently seen when the baby is breathing. But you can see the nostrils being contracting and relaxing, then it is a sign that the baby can go in for heart failure, is in heart failure. And grunting. Grunting is a very bad sign, a typical antimony tart grunting. When a baby starts grunting like a goat, that's a bad sign and a definite feature of heart failure. And lastly, rib retraction. When a baby breathes, you don't need to retract the ribs. But if you can prominently see on the chest that the ribs have been retracted with every breath, with every inspiration he or she is taking, then that is a sign of heart failure in a child.
Wow. There are a lot of excellent ways that a mother could even detect this type of thing going on with the heart, this difficulty and disorder. Thank you for giving us all of those listings. So we see all of these signs and symptoms, and what can we do once we realize, besides you said that they would go in for testing?
Yeah, I mean, the simple 2 or 3 tests are required, or the most basic test is a 2D echocardiogram. The 2D echocardiogram is the basic test for detecting cardiac failure, and it is a very simple test. Unless we get it normal, till then we don't declare the patient has or doesn't have heart failure. Other than that, one would test urine examination for the albumin, the ESR, and liver function tests. For example, if the liver has grown enlarged, then we have got liver enzymes, we have got creatinine for examination of the kidney. X-ray chest, yes, it has to be done, but then if you're doing an echo, X-ray chest today now is not a routine test which we recommend. We directly go on for echo. And in the very exceptional cases, we may need to go for cardiac catheterization or an angiogram.
Okay. And then now, let's say, are you going to give us examples of what happens after you have these test functions done?
Yeah. I mean, so once we have confirmed that this patient is a patient of heart failure, then we have to need to assess that the patient, what sort of heart failure we have got. As far as homeopathy is concerned, we have got various rubrics. For example, in the chapter of chest, we have got congestion heart, constriction night, constriction falling asleep, dilatation of the heart, then chest fullness of the heart, hepatization of the lung, dropsy, hypertrophy of the heart, infiltration of the heart, respiration difficult, midnight, respiration paroxysmal, cough, night choking. I can go on and on with these rubrics. That means multiple rubrics are there and multiple remedies are there. But first, what we need to know is, once we have diagnosed, how do we manage? Homeopathic management is more important. Rather, management is essential rather than treatment. Treatment is a very small part of management as far as any disease is concerned, irrespective of the name. And congestive cardiac failure also. So the first thing I would like to do is assess whether the patient is in acute phase or chronic phase. It's settled. If it's an acute phase, then I would see that's in what sort of management should be done. But my basic aim should be to improve the quality of life. The quality of life should be improved. these patients frequently land up in hospitalization, repeated hospitalization, monthly, 2 monthly, 6 monthly. I mean, it's a very sorry state of affairs. Not only the patient, but the entire family is perturbed. So my aim as a homeopath would be to decrease the hospitalization stay and decrease the episodes of hospitalization. If possible, if I can find out, then remove the underlying cause. Many times, I may need to advise surgery if the patient is fit for surgery. Now, in echocardiogram, there is something called as ejection fraction. It is the fraction of the blood which is ejected out. Last time also we had discussed, and should be normally greater than 80%. If it is less than 30%, if it is less than 40%, then it's heart failure. But if it's less than 30%, then surgeries on the heart fail. Normally, they are not successful. But then if my patient is between 30 to 40%, I can, if he or she is able to undergo surgery for a heart disease, a congenital heart disease, then yes, I may need to recommend. Then I can remove the precipitating cause. For example, if the patient is suffering from typhoid fever, or a dengue fever, or then septicemia, or anemia, I should correct the anemia and automatically the failure will go away. I should correct the infection, the failure will go away. Vitamin deficiencies, especially vitamin B1, I need to correct this vitamin B1, which is called beriberi. If that is so simple to for correction, I mean, various types of foodstuffs are there, you take for say a month or so and then things get corrected. Then control of congestive cardiac state proper, first and foremost, is reduction of workload, both physical workload, and this is one state where physical rest is definitely recommended. So physical rest is important, even bed rest, but now I would like to say, and should be very, very prominently said, that the bed rest, the patient should lie inclined up to 30 degrees. That means the head end should be raised 30 degrees. That is very, very essential. It helps the heart to function in a much more smoother manner.
Mm-hmm.
So, definite reduction of addictions like alcohol and smoking, because add fuel to the fire, and they would actually stop. I mean, the medications would make useless if these addictions are continued. So, alcohol and tobacco need to be definitely stopped. Bed rest, as I told you, 30 degrees inclined, head up position. That means the head side should be up and the foot end should be down. And if I can do, then treatment of obesity. Now, in such cases, Debbie, one is very important is I can't ask the patient for exercise. Then how do I reduce the obesity as far as exercise is concerned? In such cases, one of the most important things which we use here in India, and it's been very successful, is body massage. If I ask the patient not to exercise, I can ask him or her to undergo daily body massage, and this really, really helps in decreasing the not only the salt and water retention, but also the obesity to a very great extent.
Wow. Okay. So. Isn't that expensive? I'm just thinking.
No. I mean, you don't require to be always technical. I mean, there are people, your caretaker can do a simple massage. It doesn't just teach the patient how to do a massage, and it's so simple. I mean, people, just for the lack of masseurs, they don't do massage. They keep on complaining. But then we have hardly any time left. Once your organ has failed, we have to bring it back. Now, since you are forbidden to do physical exercises, and yet you have to decrease weight, especially abdominal fat, and then how do you do it? Then massage remains the only effective way. It has been time-tested since past many, many years.
It's very interesting. So you're saying this external form of movement to the body, to move the fluids, is going to help to flush the system or keep it active, or instead of the person on his own accord being able to do the physical exercise from the exterior, it's being
really
done.
And you'll be shocked, I mean, amazed to know that hardly in a week's time, we can reduce as much as 4 to 5 kgs. It's significant weight loss.
Wow. That is amazing. I'm wondering, are there any reports of such, of what you're talking about, this incidence of weight loss through massage?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about studies being documented, but in India, I mean, we have been routinely following such practices since a long, long time. In Ayurveda, massages are well known since past 2,000 years. And even Hanuman has talked about massages, positive past and negative past therapy, apart from that, massages. So we should definitely use, and heart failure, congestive heart failure, is an ideal state wherein massages are very helpful, since the patient cannot himself or herself exercise actively.
Well, it sounds very much, you know, you talk about the sympathetic nervous system, but the word sympathetic itself, to feel that your heart is a massage organ. It's constantly doing that motion of pumping, like a being massaged and massaging the body through the pumping of the blood. So to have it being done sympathetically can maybe be really, really soothing to the individual.
It is. Actually, many patients come and tell me after, say, undergoing a therapy, a massage therapy, why didn't you give us this prescription earlier? I mean, they're so, initially for 1 week or 2 weeks, the muscle pains are there. But once the myalgia is gone and once they adapt to the massage, it is really a beneficial therapy. And I do recommend in such patients of heart failure, everyone, whoever so can do so. And so simple, why not do it?
Well, that's an important point that you just mentioned, that if a person goes in for massage therapy and does feel discomfort or pain, that is to be expected until the body gets used to it?
Yeah, I mean, you have to convince the patient that initially, for a day, 2 days, or even a week probably, the muscles may pain more than as you must have expected. But that does not mean that we stop the massage. We keep on continuing. The intensity can be a bit decreased, but slowly the results are astonishing and they are very, very helpful. At least in our center and our practice, we are so happy with this massage therapy. Apart from that,
okay. Let's do a whole series, another show on massage, because I think that there can be a lot of other results, including headaches and other things with the toxins flushing through the body.
Exactly. Now, one thing interesting is we don't have only one heart in the body. The heart is one. Then we have also got peripheral hearts. The calf muscles are also called as peripheral hearts. They are very effective hearts which pump blood from the lower extremities to this major heart. So if normally in such states, in congestive cardiac failure states, these muscles are tightened and they undergo cramps. So with this massage therapy, it is so easy, without any medications, you can actually decrease the cramps and increase the blood flow from the periphery to the center. So your basic, even if your heart is weak, your peripheral hearts become stronger and still the circulation goes on near normal.
I'm sure very few people would really recognize this information. This is great. I think there's a question in the chat room that's asking, what if the patient is having an actual cardiac arrest when they like walk into your office or they're on the street?
A cardiac arrest is different from cardiac failure.
Okay.
Cardiac arrest is stoppage of the heart and it's a crisis situation. Now, it can be because of absolute loss of rhythm, or the rhythm has undergone what we call ventricular fibrillation. In such a situation, the ideal thing would be to give a DC shock. If the DC shock is not available, then the drug of choice in homeopathy would be aconite, and in the highest potency available, along with the CRP, that cardiorespiratory maneuvers, what we call cardiac massage, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. So that needs to be carried out in a cardiac arrest, whereas heart failure is different from cardiac arrest. Heart failure can end in cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest is nearly death. If you don't do anything, the patient dies. Cardiac failure would give you some time for the with the patient,
even
if it's an acute one.
Okay, that clarifies that. I don't know if there's any other questions.
I have yet not finished with, I mean, see, that is one part of the story. Second part would be the diet. And the most important thing to control swelling is low sodium diet. The salt has to be decreased, especially no salt at the table. No cooking salt as well. And the salt should be mixed. The common salt is mixed with rock salt. And it definitely has a very big impact in controlling heart failure.
Okay.
Any sort of intravenous fluids like sodium chloride or plasma, even whole blood, is strictly no-no. If blood transfusion is essential, for example, the patient has got anemia, and if a blood is required, then only a packed cells are given. The fluid is not given. The fluid blood is destroyed, and only the packed cells are given. And if the cardiac failure continues, then we may need to resort to some eccentric measures like dialysis or pacemaker. So pacemaker sometimes also helps. But as far as homeopathy is concerned, I wanted to really talk about certain drugs, which very important drugs in acute and chronic heart failure. And the four more important drugs which one can, even a homeopath can remember, is arsenic album, antim tart, carp wedge, and oxalic acid.
Oxalic acid?
Yeah, oxalic acid. So, I mean, you'd be surprised to hear, but oxalic acid is a very, very important drug for controlling heart failure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are the top four: arsenicum, antimonium tart, carboveg, and oxalic acid.
That's it, in acute heart failure. And
okay.
In chronic heart failure, we would be dealing with Lachesis, Naja, Lycopus, and Lauroserious.
Okay.
So, when we talk about arsenic, we have to know, I mean, the arsenic album, as for any other complaint, is selected on the state of disposition of the patient. There's extreme mental distress. The patient is fearful, anxious, restless, and thirsty for small sips of chilled water. I mean, patient wants water, small quantities. But the cardiac symptom in the failure state would be extreme pressure on the chest or a burning sensation in the chest. And the patient will definitely complain that I cannot get enough air in my lungs, doctor. I cannot get enough air. Even that oxygen, give me some oxygen. But then still, even in spite of the oxygen, I don't feel that I can breathe properly and I will die. These are the words of arsenic alb patients. And although it may seem very theoretical, but when we can, even in practice, daily practice, in ICU practice, we do hear such sentences, and then arsenic is the album is a choice. It is the first drug for sudden left ventricular failure and should be given, in our experience, in the highest possible potency, because acute heart failure does not give much time for us to do trial and error. So we have to have the highest potency available, and the repetition is between 15 to 20 minutes. And I should get a positive response in maximum 30 to 45 minutes. If I don't, then either my remedy is wrong or the patient has worsened. Arsenic acts very promptly. I mean, hardly one or two doses, it will definitely settle down the patient if it's an arsenic patient. But see, that arsenic state, once it's settled, the left ventricular failure is likely to again come up, relapse. To stop this relapse, we generally use either phosphorus or sulfur in 1 mg potency, one dose. So after the arsenic action is over. This is very, very important because you can't keep on giving arsenic dose after dose and dose after dose. You need to stop at some point of time. But then the failure state may relapse again. And for prevention of the relapsing, we need to give phosphorus, which we normally do. Once phosphorus is given, then the failure states settles in, the patient may be in failure, but a very settled state or a compensated phase occurs. And it's very easy to manage such cases then.
Okay, maybe it's easy for you to manage.
Yeah, I agree. But then people should know. I mean, how do you impart knowledge then? I mean,
right. So let me just clarify. When you're talking high potency, and we've mentioned this before, you're talking at least a 1 mg or higher, 10 or 50 mg or something like that.
PM. Yes, definitely. The highest potency available, definitely above 1 mg.
Okay. And then when you do, once they settle down, and when you talked about the position of the body, that you, when they are lying down. They should be propped up. This is a natural state for an arsenicum type of person.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Only other, see, the normal congestive cardiac failure patients in acute state would present, would be like an arsenic state. So arsenic becomes the natural drug of choice for such patients. Only if it's not an arsenic, then we have to search what it is. Either it can be an antimonium tart, or it can be a carbo-vegetable, or an oxalic acid. So arsenic ALB is very, very easy, because any person who cannot get enough air would be definitely restless. Any person who cannot get air would be anxious. Any person not getting enough air can have got cardiac pressure or burning in the chest. So it's quite easy for selection of arsenic ALB, and nearly 70% of patients do positively respond to arsenic ALB. Only thing is, the repetitions should not be much, only 2 or maximum 3 repetitions over a period of 30-45 minutes, and the potency should be used should be high. But then after you have done so, after the patient's bit settled down, either give him or her sulfur or phosphorus, depending on the patient is basically chilly or basically hot. One M, one dose, and then that completes the management of acute phase of heart failure after arsenic is over.
Okay.
That's our experience.
Okay, that just gets them through the crisis, but now you have to take care of them for the rest of their life. And
yeah,
so that's
exactly.
The hard part.
But then you have saved one life by just giving arsenic properly. And suppose if it's not arsenic at all, then the second drug one needs to be thinking of is antimonium tart. Antimonium tart is exactly reverse of arsenic. The arsenic is so anxious, here the antimonium tart is so depressed, hopeless, exhausted, sleepy. There is great amount of sleepiness and drowsiness, and of course thirstlessness. And if you do get a chance, then the classical milky coated tongue of antim crude and antim tart, both, you can see it, antim tart is clear, but then one needs to actually see for the milky coating, because the patient is not going to show you the tongue. But one very, very important feature that differentiates arsenic from antimonium tart is cyanosis. Cyanosis or cyanotic tinge, at least on the nose or the tongue or the fingers, should be there for prescription of antimonium tart. It's very, very important.
And along this is like a blue color or?
Yeah, bluish discoloration of the skin. If it's an obvious cyanosis, then it's very well and good. It can be seen. Because antim tart does not have cold extremities like carbovech, which we are going to discuss next. It has got warm extremities, but yet you can see the bluish discoloration, the bluish nails, the bluish discoloration of the tip of the nose, the lips. You can see them. And then that is a definite indication for antimonium tart. And when you ask the patients, or even if you see, the patient is definitely uncomfortable in the stuffiness of the room, but at the same time would not like fan or the blast of air. If or he or she likes the blast of air or the fan, then it is carbovech. So much so that in such a situation, we would obviously want, if we have got recourse to oxygen, then we want the patient to give in oxygen. The patient would not like to take that oxygen mask on the nostrils. He feels suffocated. That is antimonium tart. If you have a stethoscope, put it on the chest and you have bubbling sensations throughout. What is classically described in Allen's keynotes as death rattles. But of course, they may not be death rattles. But yes, you have got rails that is there. Normally, an antimonium tart patient would have, the medicine has to be given in high potency, and repetition should be in fractional doses in maximum 1 or 2-3 hours. It should be stopped as soon as the patient responds to your drug. That is important. It's very easy to start a remedy, but it, at the same time, one should keep in mind when to stop homeopathic drugs. Otherwise, the same drug, this would start be proving, and you'll get exacerbation of the same symptoms what which you are going to control with the drug. So that's wrong. One needs to stop the drug as soon as one gets enough results, the patient settles down.
Okay, so we have time to finish up with carboveg and oxalic acid and possibly a little of the chronics.
Yeah. Carboveg, again, we have got a mentally dull patient, foggy in the outlook. Again, one of the characteristics of carboveg is extreme air hunger, cold climbing limbs, but still the patient does not want them to be covered. Definite want of air is a very, very important feature, three-mark feature of CarboWedge. Wants, fan, wants, movement of the air, cannot bear any clothing around the neck. Along with it, definitely, we have got gaseous distension of the epigastrium and a good deal of flatulence. This CarboWedge patient would crave oxygen. They would ask, please give us oxygen, doctor, give me oxygen. And the BP would be low, the pulse, the rate of the pulse would be low, and the volume of the pulse would be low. Now, the very important distinguishing feature between, very few people know actually, between arsenic and CarboWedge, as far as pulse is concerned, arsenic will have tachycardia, that means the rate will be above 120 per minute, whereas CarboWedge would have bradycardia, the rate would be less than 60 per minute. That is a very essential feature. Of course, both will have low BP. CarboWedge also will have low BP, as well as arsenic would be having low BP. And again, when we stop CarboWedge, the next drug, the continuous good effects would be CaliCarb.
Okay. CaliCarb would be follow-up then?
Yes. I normally give, once I'm finished with the CarboWedge, I see the patient is settled with CarboWedge, I can't keep repeating high potencies, 10M potencies again and again. So I give 1 or 2 or 3 doses. Once the patient is settled, then within an hour, I give 1 dose of CaliCarb, and the patients definitely settle down.
Okay. Oxalic acid. Potassium carbonate?
Yeah, potassium carbonate. And it's a very effective remedy, and follows CarboWedge, the action of CarboWedge, very, very well.
Okay, and this one is, are you continuing with a high potency?
Again, yeah. Only 1M, 1 dose, CaliCarb.
Okay.
That's enough. CarboWedge, of course, high potency. All the 3 drugs which I have mentioned, and again the 4th I'm going to mention, are high potencies, and they need to be repeated only once, twice, or maximum thrice in an acute state. The 4th drug is oxalic acid. Now, the classical feature of any acid would be exhaustion, intense exhaustion. The patient may not have extreme breathlessness like CarboWedge, intense air hunger like CarboWedge, or restlessness like arsenic, or the sleepiness and drowsiness like Antimtar. But extreme exhaustion, and that is very, very frequently found in a heart failure patients, an acute heart failure, exhaustion is very difficult to control. And oxalic acid is a master drug for controlling intense exhaustion. And the patient would say, doc, my extremities, my limbs have a sense of numbness. They have become cold and clammy. And that, again, you may have some sort of cyanosis or bluish discoloration, but then that would not be generalized discoloration. It would be a mottled appearance. A bluish tinge on the entire skin would be seen with oxalic acid. Now, these patients are in contrast to arsenic patients. They don't want movement at all. They prefer lying dead still. And that movement of any kind increases their distress, their breathlessness, their exhaustion, their fatigue. So oxalic acid, the keynote for recognizing whether my patient is oxalic acid would be an alert patient, not sleepy patient, at the same time would be very still and would be very, very worn out and intensely exhausted.
Right. It kind of reminds me a little bit of bryonia.
Yeah, bryonia. But then bryonia, we have tried, and bryonia does not act as well as oxalic acid in such situations.
Okay.
Because other than that symptom, oxalic acid does not have much thirst as a bryonia patient in an acute state would have so. But yes, so that's why I purposely mentioned oxalic acid, because it's a slightly uncommon drug to be thought of in an acute state. I mean, one would not think of oxalic acid. But then really it has paid off in many of our patients, and still does once we know this beautiful remedy.
Okay, we have about 4 minutes left. Do you want to talk about the chronic remedies, or do you want to save this? What would you like to do for today?
No, I mean, see, for chronic remedies, I mean, there are so many other remedies I would like to discuss. 2 more important remedies which I would definitely have discussed are the digitalis and China.
Okay.
Digitalis and China are, again, excellent remedy for controlling heart failure. And digitalis per se is the wonder drug which increases the force of contraction of a failing heart. Mind you, if a normal person takes the digitalis, it does not increase the force of contraction. Only in a failing heart, the seat of action is the atrioventricular node. And a digitalis patient, again, is very anxious, like an arsenic patient, has got suffocative spells, but very dull in appearance and quite lethargic. And digitalis is strictly contraindicated when the heart failure is because of acute myocardial infarction, because the moment we start digitalis, it slows the pulse and makes it irregular. And that is a very, very big problem with digitalis. So, the clinical use is, arsenic should be used when we have got heart failure without arrhythmias, without rhythm disturbances. And if heart failure is there with rhythm disturbances, like atrial fibrillation, then digitalis is the drug of choice. Another very, very important feature with digitalis is cough with bloody and frothy mucus, like ipecac. Cough with bloody and frothy mucus, along with all of these, which is not there in arsenic, it is digitalis, and another wonderful remedy in acute heart failure, again to be used not in low potency, not in mother tincture form, but again 1 mL or above.
Okay. I was going to mention that, you know, the medical community does use digitalis. So comparing it homeopathically to the crude drug.
Very, very important feature of the difference between allopathic digitalis and homeopathic digitalis use. The allopathic digitalis, they have to use it for lifelong. Till the patient stays alive, digitalis has to be taken. In homeopathy, even if we start the patient with mother tinctures, but there is something called as digitalis toxicity, which occurs with quite a many number of patients in allopathy side. When it is used in material doses, 0.5 milligrams or 0.25 milligrams, and 5 days a week, the normal dosage is there in allopathy. In spite of that, if the patient undergoes hypo or hypercalcemia or any sort of electrolyte imbalance, patients do land up quite frequently with digitalis toxicity, like nausea, like intense vomiting, like jaundice, like increased spleen or liver, or you start getting different types of arrhythmias, like the double beating pulse or missed beats, which are very characteristic of digitalis. And in such cases, digitalis needs to be stopped. Now what do you give to the patient? So the allopaths don't have any other drug other than digitalis to be given. But in homeopathy, even with mother tinctures, even if it has to be continued lifelong, till now we have never noticed, not in a single patient, we have noticed any sort of digitalis toxicity in such patients. That's a very big advantage of homeopathic digitalis, mother tincture, or low potency, and allopathic digitalis. Although the drug is same, but the potency does matter.
Very good. Okay, I guess we'll finish up. The next show, we'll learn about China officinalis and the chronic remedies, Lachesis, Nausea, Lycopus, and Laura Sorensis, and whatever else you want to teach us about heart failure and heart health. I want to thank you so much. Really getting educational material out to the public and health practitioners. And we're going to exit today and see you next Wednesday at noon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chinthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.